This is 1A. Happy Friday. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. On this day 50 years ago, a lunar module was on its way to making history. The following day, Apollo 11 touched down on the moon and turned two astronauts into American heroes.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
The landing site is called the Sea of Tranquility. This week's news was anything but tranquil. The president has spent the last few days defending a racist tweet attacking four minority congresswomen. The House has voted to hold the attorney general and the commerce secretary in contempt of Congress. And there's growing tension in Puerto Rico as residents demand accountability in a scandal involving the island's governor. But we begin with immigration today on the Friday News Roundup. Joining us in studio today is Byron York, chief political correspondent for the Washington Examiner. Byron, welcome back to the Roundup.
Thanks for having me.
Cheryl Gay Stolberg is a congressional correspondent for the New York Times. Cheryl, welcome.
Thank you, Joshua.
And Eugene Scott is a political reporter for the Washington Post. Hey, Eugene.
Glad to be here.
We'll get to the president's tweet in just a bit, but let's start with immigration. A new rule from the administration will require migrants seeking asylum in the U.S. to first apply for asylum in the first country they physically pass through en route to America. The change is a big blow to migrants from Central America in particular who pass through Mexico en route to the United States. Cheryl Gay Stolberg, let me start with you. NPR's John Burnett recently interviewed Mark Morgan, who's the acting head of Customs and Border Protection. Morgan called it a pilot program and said it's only being implemented in two border stations. What is the status of this rule? Is it in effect or is it just a test?
Well, if it's a pilot program, I assume it's going into effect. However, it's being litigated in court. Immigrant rights groups say that this rule is illegal. The current asylum policy says that if you are already in the United States and you have a well-founded fear of going back to your home country because of persecution or, you know, threat to bodily harm to you, then you can apply for asylum. This rule will require people to apply for asylum in a third country before reaching the United States. So effectively, that limits asylum seekers now to those from Mexico or those overseas. And immigrants' rights groups are saying that is illegal. It goes against the law enacted by Congress governing asylum, and they're asking a federal court to issue an injunction preventing it from going into effect.
Byron York, I wonder if we have a sense of what the scope of this could be. I mean, the third country piece was something that came up not too long ago when President Trump was meeting with Mexico's foreign minister. He had threatened tariffs against Mexico unless Mexico took more action on immigration, and this third country concept came up then. So it would seem that we're kind of clear that this would have an effect in a way that the administration has already kind of pushed for.
Well, the bigger picture here is the Trump administration is trying to find any way it can to reduce the flow of illegal crossings across the U.S.-Mexico border. They reached a peak in May of about an annual rate of about a million per year. And the biggest problem, as the Trump administration sees it, is that the flow has changed from many years ago in which it was mostly single adult men. Now it is more than half families with children. And from the administration's point of view, they cannot be detained for any great period of time, and they cannot be immediately returned either. So the idea is to reduce the flow. That's why the administration pushed Mexico to do more enforcement at Mexico's southern border with the Northern Triangle countries. And that's why it's doing this. It's pushing for people who have applied for asylum in the United States to wait in Mexico or for people to apply in their home countries, but do anything but illegally cross into the United States. The people in the Northern Triangle countries follow the news in the United States. I mean, this is very clear. A lot of illegal crossings slowed when President Trump first came into office, and when it became clear that the courts and Democrats in Congress would basically try to block anything Trump was doing along the border, the flow increased.
And indeed, the southern border of Mexico is going to get more policing as part of the deal that Mexico
Correct.
Made with the U.S. And just to clarify, you mentioned the annualized statistic in May of a million a year. Just to be clear on what you meant, that if that rate from May held steady for a year,
Right.
it would add up to a million.
Now, it has slowed down somewhat
Right.
in June. And there's kind of a controversy over whether that's the normal annual slowdown when this super hot weather along the border comes in, or whether it is actually the result of something the administration and Mexico have done.
Now, Eugene, the acting head of the Department of Homeland Security, Secretary Kevin McAleenan, kicked off his congressional testimony this week with a call to end what he called false and overheated attacks on CBP officers. Here is part of what Acting Secretary McAleenan said.
The incendiary and overwrought attacks on the men and women securing our border and enforcing the immigration laws in the interior are unwarranted and damaging. The demonization of law enforcement professionals, U.S. Border Patrol agents, CBP and ICE officers from all racial and ethnic backgrounds, from all faiths and callings, who have chosen a career about protecting others, must stop.
That was Acting DHS Secretary Kevin McAleenan speaking to the House Oversight and Reform Committee yesterday. Eugene, were there any other highlights to his testimony? Did we learn anything new?
I thought the most revealing part of the testimony is just what the plan could possibly look like, even though it's not finalized. But what was very interesting to the point he just made, the comments, that was one of the first times we've seen someone at that level respond to what presumably are attacks from the left and the base targeted towards law enforcement, people doing their jobs, people carrying out their responsibilities. We've seen photos of CBP officers go viral on social media, accusations that they're complicit in the parts of this administration's immigration policy that people find troublesome. And his defending them, I thought, was a first at that level regarding what many people are attacking.
There was also, Eugene, the matter of this private Facebook group that came to light not too long ago where some CBP officers are accused of posting racial slurs and sexist images. Did McAleenan address that?
I didn't hear that, him directly address that.
Cheryl,
I should read it.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so he actually did. You might have missed that in the hearing. He did actually address it in a very charged moment with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. This Facebook group included lewd and, you know, sexually explicit posts involving actually the congresswoman. And she asked him directly, don't you think that these kinds of posts lead to a dehumanizing culture within the agency? And she also asked him directly, are the people responsible for these posts still on the job? He said that these posts were inexcusable, that they were being investigated. The agency was going to look into them promptly. He couldn't say which officers were still on the job and which weren't, but he said that the agency has no tolerance for those kinds of posts, which I found actually kind of intriguing given what Eugene said about his pushback about the way his agents are being characterized by the left. The left is now seeing itself characterized in a very unflattering way by his agents.
Byron, another big story out of the House this week on Wednesday was that the House voted to hold two top government officials in contempt over this fight to add a citizenship question to the census. Attorney General William Barr and the Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross, the census is part of the Commerce Department, they're both being held in criminal contempt of Congress per this House vote for refusing to turn over documents or testify related to the citizenship question. Now, Byron, this has already gone through the courts. It's already been argued. The Supreme Court kicked it back and said, you need a better reason. The president said, we'll do it another way. What about these documents? What's the argument for why members of Congress want them?
Yeah. Well, the administration says the Congress or Democrats in Congress want them to embarrass the administration. I mean, the Trump administration has been all over the lot on this census thing. A number of conservatives thought they had a reasonable case to make for including the question and wanted to see the administration defend this. The Attorney General Barr said that they had a legal rationale to do it that was better than the one they used, which got the mixed results or mostly negative results in the Supreme Court.
Which, we should be clear, that was what the court asked for. They said
exactly.
You can't put the question on unless you give a stronger
argument.
Come
back with a better reason,
right.
And then you might be able to do it. And clearly the census has asked questions about citizenship for many, many, many decades, and they still do in something called the American Community Service Survey, which goes out to, is it 3%, I think, of the U.S. population sampling. And it's that they use to actually enforce parts of the Voting Rights Act. But the bottom line is the administration is basically saying, look, to Congress, look, you just want this stuff to embarrass us. My feeling is they're probably going to have to end up handing it over at some point.
We'll continue the roundup in just a moment with the Washington Examiner's Byron York, Cheryl Gay Stolberg of the New York Times, and Eugene Scott of the Washington Post. We all hope you're listening to us from a cool, comfortable place, because those could be hard to come by this weekend. A heat wave is expected in two-thirds of the country. The National Weather Service says 90% of Americans will see temperatures above 90 degrees this weekend. It could feel like 110 degrees or more in a number of major cities, including here in Washington and in Chicago. In New York, the lows are not expected to drop below 80, even overnight. Experts, of course, recommend drinking lots of water, avoiding using the fan when it's 95 degrees or hotter, because that just pushes hot air around, and watching out for the signs of heat-related illness. Those can include muscle spasms, dizziness, nausea, vomiting, or skin that gets hot but does not sweat. You'll find more information on how to deal with extreme heat at the government's disaster preparedness site, which is ready.gov. I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR.
Support for this NPR podcast and the following message come from BetterHelp. BetterHelp offers licensed professional counselors who specialize in issues such as depression, stress, anxiety, and more. Connect with your professional counselor in a safe and private online environment at your convenience. Get help at your own time and your own pace. Schedule secure video or phone sessions, plus chat and text with your therapist. Visit BetterHelp.com/1A to learn more and get 10% off your first month.
The world is complicated, but knowing the past can help us understand it so much better.
That's where we come in. I'm Rand Abdel-Fattah.
I'm Ramtin Arablouei, and we're the hosts of Throughline, NPR's history podcast.
Every week, we'll dig into forgotten stories from the moments that shaped our world.
Throughline from NPR. Listen and subscribe now.
Memorials will take place next week for the late Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens. He died Tuesday in Fort Lauderdale after suffering a stroke. Stevens wrote a number of pivotal opinions, including banning capital punishment of mentally disabled convicts, requiring due process for detainees at Guantanamo Bay, and allowing Paula Jones to sue President Bill Clinton for sexual harassment. Many considered him the leader of the court's liberal faction. He often said that he did not move left, the court moved right. But he told the PBS NewsHour he disagreed with the stricter conservative view of the Constitution's text.
Everybody agrees that it's appropriate to do everything you can to understand the original intent behind both statutes and constitutional provisions. But the notion that that can provide the answer in all cases is what is incorrect. It sheds light on all cases, but it's just one of the tools you have to use.
Justice Stevens will lie in repose at the Supreme Court on Monday for public viewing. A private funeral takes place Tuesday, followed by his interment at Arlington National Cemetery. Justice John Paul Stevens lived to be 99. He's survived by a large family, including 13 great-grandchildren. It's the Friday News Roundup with Cheryl Gay Stolberg of the New York Times, Eugene Scott of the Washington Post, and Byron York of the Washington Examiner. We welcome your questions and thoughts, especially on a story that's had the whole country talking in one way or another, the series of racist tweets that President Trump issued on Sunday morning. They were directed at, but not naming specifically, four freshman female Democratic congresswomen nicknamed The Squad: Rashida Tlaib of Michigan, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York, Ilhan Omar of Minnesota, and Ayanna Pressley of Massachusetts. Some people say, Eugene, that the tweets were a distraction. Others say the president's words were so racist they had to be discussed, even if they are meant to distract. If you're President Trump, did you look back on this week feeling like you got what you wanted, like you were taken out of context? I hate to make you read the president's mind, but from the president's perspective, what is there to gain?
I think the president made it clear earlier this year that he is focused on turnout when it comes to 2020, not really winning swing voters or some people that he knew he had to win, you know, from suburban districts and on the bubble in 2016. And by speaking to the issues that are of most importance to his base, such as concerns about maybe hardline immigration policies and just the politics in general of the Democratic Party's base, I think the president thinks that he may have scored a win. These are people who are with him. There's a Reuters poll that said that after the tweets went up, approval ratings for Trump went up 5% with Republicans and Republican-leaning voters, and speaking to some of, quite frankly, the cultural anxieties that his supporters said led them to vote for him in 2016, I think keeps them close to him.
What about that, Cheryl, the way that this might play out among moderate Republicans, among Democrats? This is primary election season, so maybe that's even too far down the road to even be looking.
Well, I think Republicans are very concerned about how this is going to play out. And you saw that on Capitol Hill this week when a number of Republicans took a very rare step in standing up to the president. You had the Republican leader of the House saying these tweets have and these kinds of comments have no place in our – actually, let me amend that. Republicans did not actually rebuke Trump for the tweets. When they began to rebuke Trump was after a rally in North Carolina when the crowd erupted into chants of send her back, send her back.
Here's a little bit of the sound of that rally from Greenville, North Carolina on Wednesday.
And obviously and importantly, Omar has a history of launching vicious anti-Semitic screeds.
The crowd chanting, send her back, from that rally in Greenville, North Carolina on Wednesday. Cheryl?
So that was really a bridge too far for Republicans. Republican leader Kevin McCarthy said there was no place for these this kind of language in our society. Other Republicans pleaded with Vice President Mike Pence to tell the president to tone it down. Ivanka Trump, the president's daughter, approached him. And the president actually did try to walk it back a little bit, telling reporters who asked him, why didn't you put a stop to it? He said, well, I didn't like that. I don't agree with it. And I tried to jump in very quickly. But as you heard on the tape, he did not try to jump in very quickly. He spoke as the crowd was beginning to rev up that chant. And as they did chant, he remained silent, speaking only again after the crowd settled down.
Now, the tweets, again, Byron, have kind of started this conversation across the country about the nature of racism. And we've got a variety of different comments from several of you who read the tweets and have seen the debate thereafter. Sean emailed, Trump's racist tweet is a distraction tactic. From Trump's perspective, the subset of his supporters who are closet racists love him even more. Bonus, everyone has pretty much stopped asking about his connections to Epstein. For Trump, it's a win-win, referring to Jeffrey Epstein, the billionaire who is now being charged with sex trafficking. Susan writes, there is not racism in the tweet to go back where you came from. Nationalism, yes, but not racism. The tweet is not racist. It is interpreted wrong and simplistically. Byron, what do you make of this kind of debate across the country about the R word?
Well, I'm certainly not going to settle it here. I mean, there were some people who were not overly hostile to Trump who were okay with the word xenophobic, but they didn't go for racist. You know, what can I say about that? I think what we've seen, and we're in day six of this. I remember when this happened on Sunday, somebody said, this is going to take the whole week. And I said, no, that can't be true. But of course, it was true. And I think this has moved from a more from the outrage stage to a more strategic stage. I'm not saying that Trump planned this. I mean, he does like the idea of making the squad the sort of living logo of the Democratic Party, but he's, you know, he's not that strategic that he could have planned this whole thing. But I think it was clear, you know, what Cheryl says about the rally is right, but before the rally, he was beginning to back off. He tweeted on Wednesday before the rally about the squad, quote, they're entitled to their opinion, they're Americans. I'm entitled to my opinion, and I just think they're left-wing cranks. So that was a different tone than go back home. So I think the president thought he had made his point. He had attached the squad to the larger Democratic Party. Clearly he did not tell the crowd to stop chanting "Send her back." He actually waited until it subsided, and then he resumed his speech. I think he's probably made his point and is ready to move on.
In terms of strategy, one thing I think may have happened this week between the tweets and us now on this sixth day is this may be the latest example of Trump putting something out there and those around him cleaning it up. And so when you look at people who've written op-eds in defense of his and lawmakers who've been willing to be interviewed, they have said it a bit more, as appropriately or in a way that didn't seem as offensive. The phrase "go back" is rooted in racism. If you look at the history of this country, if you look at how people responded to Italian immigrants, Irish immigrants, and black people after the abolition of slavery. But other people saying, if you do not agree with the political ideology of this current president and administration, then perhaps you can leave. That's not what Trump said initially. That is what some of his defenders have said days later.
And just because that we're so far out in the news cycle, let me just read the three tweets that caused all this, just so, because it's been kind of muddled in the news cycle, just so you can hear it afresh. Here is the series of the three tweets that started all this. On July 14th, the president tweeted, quote, "So interesting to see quote-unquote progressive Democrat congresswomen who originally came from countries whose governments are a complete and total catastrophe, the worst, most corrupt, and inept anywhere in the world, if they even have a functioning government at all, now loudly and viciously telling the people of the United States, the greatest and most powerful nation on earth, how our government is to be run. Why don't they go back and help fix the totally broken and crime-infested places from which they came? Then come back and show us how it is done. These places need your help badly. You can't leave fast enough. I'm sure that Nancy Pelosi would be very happy to quickly work out free travel arrangements." Unquote. That's the series of tweets the president sent on July 14th. Cheryl, what does it mean? And I'm asking this as a black man who's trying to bite his tongue. What does this mean that at this point we are debating the meaning of racism? Why don't we agree that this is racist? I mean, there was even a debate within NPR. Keith Woods, who's their head of newsroom training and diversity, a very learned man for whom I have a lot of respect, argued in an opinion piece this week that journalists should not use labels like racist, describe the behavior and let other people call it racist. Many people feel that it is incumbent upon us to use the R word. And, you know, pro tip, white people, if your white friends have to tell your friends that you are not racist, you might be a racist. How is this happening?
First off, I just want to say I feel your pain as a black man in this country.
I'm talking about as a journalist, to be able to just say, well, that thing is actually racist and here's why.
I think journalists wrestle with words all the time. This is not new. When George W. Bush was president, journalists wrestled with whether or not to use the word torture to describe what CIA agents were doing in black sites. When Donald Trump ran for president, journalists wrestled with whether to use the word lie to describe his utterances. And we at the New York Times came down on the side of using that word very sparingly. So now we have another one of these debates that also speaks to the deep divisions within our country, where we have a country that is so divided that we have people saying this is patently racist, and we have other people saying, oh no, he didn't mean anything by this. So, and news organizations have taken different paths. Marty Baron, who's the editor of the Washington Post, someone I greatly admire and have worked with, said that the Post has determined that his words fit the definition of racism precisely because, as Eugene said, this sort of go back trope is deeply rooted in the history of racism in our country. The Times tends to say remarks that have widely been described as racist. So there you have it.
Byron, how do you see it?
Well, I actually agree with Cheryl about this. I'm sure there are plenty of journalists who believe it was racist who do not believe that it's their job to tell the reader this is racist. And clearly, some people have made that decision. CNN, I think, used the phrase racist tweets zillions of times in case anyone might miss it. But this is, I think there are two different issues here. There's one, was this actually racist as you define racism? And two, should a news organization tell its listeners and readers that this was racist?
Let's shift gears now to Puerto Rico, where rubber bullets and tear gas canisters were shot into a crowd of protesters yesterday. They were marching on the mansion of Puerto Rico's governor, Ricardo Rosselló. Thousands of people have called for Governor Rosselló's resignation after an investigative news site leaked 900 pages of offensive text messages between the governor and his advisors. NPR's Adrian Florido is in San Juan, Puerto Rico, and joins us now with the latest. Adrian, welcome to the program.
Hi, Joshua. Thank you.
Tell us about the protests. What's been going on? This is the fifth or about the fifth straight day of protest, right?
Today is the sixth day. Yeah. And, you know, these protests started to gain steam over the last weekend after, as you mentioned, the Centro de Periodismo Investigativo published these text messages that were leaked to them that basically showed the governor of Puerto Rico, Ricardo Rosselló, and his members of his inner circle, his cabinet, engaging in really awful, using really awful homophobic, misogynistic language to talk about political opponents, about women, about everyday Puerto Ricans. And people started calling for his resignation. It was sort of this spark that got people to sort of see that, well, I guess to sort of feel that their government didn't actually care about the many struggles that Puerto Ricans face right now. So they started over the weekend and they've been gaining steam ever since. On Wednesday, there was a massive protest here in Old San Juan, beginning at the Capitol building and going all the way to the governor's mansion. And it was the biggest protest that Puerto Rico has seen in decades.
Yeah, with regards to what Puerto Ricans are dealing with, I wonder, from your perspective, how this fits into the larger context of everything that's been happening in Puerto Rico since Hurricane Maria and before.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Puerto Rico has been, especially over the last decade or so, going through sort of all kinds of crises, right? One of them is the economic crisis, the recession that Puerto Rico plunged into in 2006, 2 years before the global recession began. And that recession has driven hundreds of thousands of people from the island. There is the debt crisis, which is, you know, Puerto Rico is buried in billions and billions of dollars of debt that it has been unable to pay. The U.S. Congress appointed a federal oversight board to take control of the island's finances. There have been all kinds of austerity measures and budget cuts imposed on the island as a result of that, which have slashed public services. And then, of course, Hurricane Maria in 2017 and the sort of local and federal government's bungled response to that, which many Puerto Ricans were furious about and continue to be very sensitive about. And so, you know, all of these things have made Puerto Ricans, have put Puerto Ricans in a very precarious situation in terms of their basic abilities to survive on the island. And so when these chats were leaked and published and showing the governor and his top advisors who are supposed to be addressing the concerns of Puerto Ricans, showing them sort of mocking often and making fun of and making light of these situations that people are living through, it was really kind of a final straw for people. People are furious and they've taken to the streets.
One last thing, Adrian. Governor Rosselló, as I understand it, was not terribly super popular before all this happened. What has he been saying to try to mend fences, or is he likely to resign?
He said over and over again that he's not going to resign. Every time he says that, you know, the protests grow. He said in a statement he released yesterday that he thinks that he can achieve reconciliation with the people who have basically turned against him. But protesters are saying that it's absolutely not possible. There's another major, massive protest expected on Monday that's supposed to take over one of San Juan's biggest highways, the biggest highway, in fact.
And hey, one quick fact check. President Trump tweeted this week that the U.S. Congress gave $92 billion to Puerto Rico, quote, for hurricane relief, much of which was squandered away or wasted, never to be seen again, unquote. In our last few seconds, is that true?
No, it's not true. The amount of money that has arrived in Puerto Rico is significantly smaller than that. You know, people here aren't really, I mean, you know, the big story here is what's happening locally. I know that Trump has tweeted since this scandal began about it, and no one is paying attention to what President Trump is saying, because it's they've got other things to worry about right now.
That's NPR's Adrian Florido in San Juan, Puerto Rico. Adrian, thanks for talking to us.
Thanks, Joshua.
We'll get back to the roundup in just a moment. Stay close.
Building a good relationship with your doctor can be really hard, especially when it feels like you have such a short amount of time with them.
I don't know what it is about walking into the doctor's office, but it's incredibly easy to forget half of what you wanted to tell the doctor.
Check out NPR Life Kit's new guide on navigating doctor-patient relationships, or subscribe to Life Kit All Guides for all of our episodes all in one place.
Let me get to some of your comments before we move on. With regards to Puerto Rico, Tony tweeted, "I really hope that tourists will not avoid Puerto Rico. They need our dollars and our support." With regards to immigration, quite a few of you wrote in to ask something similar to what Laura wrote. Laura asked, "Please correct me. If one is seeking asylum, they are not crossing illegally. True or false?" Eugene?
From my understanding, that is true, that you can come to the border to seek asylum legally, according to current laws in the U.S. government, and that that is what the Trump administration is trying to change.
But you have to come through a legal border crossing to do it.
You have to
come through an established border crossing and surrender.
And then you have to convince officials, and this is pretty easy to do right now, that you have a credible fear of persecution in your home country. And I believe the vast majority of asylum applicants are ultimately denied asylum. We're talking over 80%, I believe, ultimately are ruled to not have a valid reason for asylum.
But to that point, I want to make sure we're clear, because I think I hear where Laura is coming from. I want to make sure we're clear on what the actual controversy is. It's not so much, and correct me if I'm wrong, it's not so much about the legality of asylum. Asylum is an internationally recognized convention. It's kind of about the nature of asylum in the U.S., the impact on the border, the impact on immigration, whether or not we can handle it or we should have the policies that we have, whether other countries like Mexico should be a larger part of the flow of potential asylees into the U.S. That seems to be more the debate as opposed to, like, are you allowed to do this?
I think it's also, certainly for Republicans and conservatives, it's an issue of the United States government controlling who enters into the country. I mean, none of us flying into the country from international destinations. You fly into Chicago, you fly into Atlanta. The United States government demands that you produce documents to show that you have a legal right to be here. And I don't think anybody would want to do away with that system. So when you have thousands of people a day coming across the border where there's just a vehicle fence or something like that, and presenting themselves to the Border Patrol, they're not trying to elude being captured. They present themselves, here we are. I mean, it's the just sheer chaos of the situation, plus the overwhelming numbers that have created this terrible humanitarian crisis, because we do have a responsibility to treat people humanely when they do this. But we need to control who comes into the United States.
Well, I think that's part of the argument, Cheryl, is that because there has been this sudden, intense flow of people, that Customs and Border Patrol, they're not built for this.
That they're completely overwhelmed. Yeah. That's exactly right. And I do think, though, Joshua, that in the public mind, it does get conflated with the debate over illegal immigration. People see on the news, you know, people coming to this country, they don't distinguish so much between asylum seekers and those who come here illegally. So I think the questioner raised a very important point.
I think one of the reasons people conflate is because you have people who have immigrated to the United States legally being told to go back to their countries when they disagree with a worldview. There are some people who are here in America legally who some Americans do not want to be here.
Also, can I make a point of fact about the three congresswomen? Only one of them was not born in this country. Ilhan Omar is a Somali refugee. The others, Rashida Tlaib of Palestinian descent, Ayanna Pressley, who's African-American, and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who are Latina, were all born in the United States.
With regards to what you just mentioned, though, Eugene, Brian tweeted, Why aren't people attacking the idea in those tweets that if you disagree with the administration, you should leave the U.S.? The last line of the 1A, the First Amendment, for which this program is named, the last line of the 1A gives us the right to petition the government for a redress of grievances. There is nothing more American than dissent. Byron, I'm interested in your take on Brian's point, because that has also been a big part of the argument, not just now, this week, with President Trump's tweet, but this idea of being kind of a true believer or in line with the president, or even among Republicans and conservatives, whether it is safe or politic or sustainable to say, yeah, I like the president, but.
Well, look, I think years and years ago, in earlier cultural wars, there was a saying, America, love it or leave it. Mm. Trump kind of turned that into President Trump, love me or leave it. And it was clearly the wrong thing to do. And I think, as I mentioned earlier, by Wednesday, before the rally, when he tweeted, they're entitled to their opinion, they're Americans. You know, it took him 3 days, but he figured out that's the line he should take.
I'll be interested to see what happens at the next rally. Everyone or many people remember John McCain stepping in at a town hall when a woman said she didn't trust Barack Obama. He was Muslim or an Arab. And McCain said, no, no, ma'am. He's a good American with whom I happen to disagree.
And took the mic from her.
Exactly. So I think we'll see what happens at the next Trump rally if the crowd does break out into these kinds of chants.
Before we move on to other stuff, one more tweet about this. Susan tweeted, let's take the focus off Trump and engage in other discussions, please. Eugene, that seems to be easier said than done for a lot of reasons. Not the least of which, you know, Ilhan Omar went back to Minnesota to her district yesterday and was greeted at the airport with like a crowd that had signs and bullhorns and was cheering for her. So, you know, we may take the focus off, but there's plenty of Americans who really want the focus to stay on, not the least of which being, I bet, Democratic strategists who are going to point to this in about a year's time and say, see, do you really want to reelect this guy?
Indeed. And we've seen people on both sides of the aisle say, let's take the focus off of this and talk about the ideas, right? We saw the members of the squad tweet out, here are the ideas that people on the right are calling radical. And we've seen in the press conference from Republican lawmakers say, we actually find these ideas from the left to be troublesome, which is why we're attacking them. And so there certainly have been efforts from people trying to say, let's talk about policy. But it's very difficult to talk about that when one of the people shaping the conversation is the leader of the free world.
It's also worth noting. Oh, go ahead, Brian.
One additional thing. Jim Clyburn, number three in the Democratic leadership in the House, did say that Democrats have got to ignore what Trump is doing. I think he was upset that the House had actually passed a bill to gradually increase the federal minimum wage to $15. Got totally lost, completely lost in all of this other stuff. So there are a number people on all sides of this have a variety of motives to try to move on.
Including, I think, you know, in the press conference that the squad held this week, Ayanna Pressley, who was a congresswoman from Massachusetts, spoke first. And that was exactly one of the things she said is, we will not let this become a distraction. We want to focus on health care and education and other policy matters.
And it became a distraction.
And it became a distraction. Let us not be distracted further and move on to a few more stories before our time is up. Maybe one of the other stories that got lost for you this week in the discussion of this tweet had to do with Planned Parenthood and its president, Dr. Lena Wen. You may remember we had her on this program earlier when she was made the president of Planned Parenthood. Well, this week she was removed after 8 months of leading the organization. According to Dr. Wen, her dismissal was the result of, quote, philosophical differences over the direction and future of Planned Parenthood, unquote. Now, the board of directors behind Wen's removal expressed a desire for more aggressive leadership amid recent efforts to roll back access to abortion around the country. So, Cheryl, it sounds like Dr. Wen wasn't political enough for Planned Parenthood. Is that it?
I think you might be able to frame it that way. Dr. Wen comes out of a public health background. She was Baltimore's health commissioner, a very respected one, before she became president of Planned Parenthood. And when she took the job at Planned Parenthood, she tried to inject a focus on health into its mission. She wanted its website to talk about topics like asthma and the common cold. She felt that It would be better to frame it as a health provider, and that is how to protect the right to abortion. But as these state laws kept popping up, and as we have seen an assault on abortion rights around the country, I think the board felt that they wanted someone who would stand up to that. And I think it does speak to kind of an internal conflict within the organization, which is, what is it? Is it a health group or is it a political group?
Well, and Eugene, it's interesting that's part of what the board said, because Dr. Nguyen does have or did take a very different tack than her predecessor, Cecile Richards, who was much more politically focused.
Indeed. I think there's some anxiety among people on the left that if this group is viewed solely as an organization that focuses on abortion, that is an issue that will not be successful with independent voters and perhaps some swing voters heading into the 2020 election. And so the idea that they needed to broaden their focus and show how valuable this organization is beyond abortion was a priority for them. But there are others on the left who said, no, this is not an issue that we are going to allow to be framed in a way that is not true to how people who support abortion as a right that women should have believe it is. And so like worldview regarding this issue and its susceptibility in the larger political climate, it's been what is up for debate.
A few more stories before we let you go. The name Scalia has a long history in U.S. government. The late Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia served 30 years on the bench until he passed in 2016. Now his son, Eugene Scalia, could be the nation's next Secretary of Labor. Byron, yesterday President Trump announced that he had nominated Eugene Scalia to succeed Alexandra Acosta, who resigned last week over questions around his handling of the Epstein case when he was the U.S. Attorney in South Florida. What do we know about Eugene Scalia and his background and his qualifications?
Well, he has been in the area of labor law for quite a while. As you said, he is Antonin Scalia's son, a conservative lawyer, was actually nominated by George W. Bush to be the solicitor of the Labor Department in 2001. Was never confirmed. Democrats won't confirm him, and they won't vote to confirm him now. And Bush actually put him in with a series of recess appointments. Then he's had large fights with organized labor. There was something called the ergonomics rule that was extremely controversial inside the Labor Department. And basically, you know, in a Democratic administration, the Labor Department becomes kind of an office of the AFL-CIO, and in a Republican administration, it becomes kind of a right to work office. And so that's what's happened here. And I would look for him to be confirmed with, unless something pops up, with between 50 and 53 votes, which is the number of Republicans you have in the Senate.
Eugene, before we go, we definitely want to mention a Washington Post investigation that came out this week that had to do with the opioid epidemic and data from the DEA. It found that more than 75 billion opioid pills were distributed from 2006 to 2012, mostly from six companies. What does this tell us about the nature or the scope of the opioid epidemic?
Well, just that it was far more widespread than I think many Americans were even aware of. I know CVS and Walgreens were named among those six companies, and attorneys for these companies said that they were simply responding to a medical crisis where doctors are overprescribing for very legitimate sometimes concerns that patients have, but also not. And they were just responding to the needs. And so what was also really fascinating about the revelation was that there were all these settlements that happened that would provide better insight into just how widespread the problem was. But, you know, with these settlements come NDAs. And so people weren't talking about it.
Non-disclosure agreements.
And had people been able to be more open about the crisis, perhaps it could have been stopped before it got out of control.
Cheryl, what kind of impact does this have, I wonder? I mean, Oklahoma is trying to hold Johnson & Johnson accountable for the opioid crisis there. It's suing Johnson & Johnson in the civil suit that wrapped up this week. What does this mean in terms of holding companies responsible, or doctors or manufacturers or pharmacies or the government for not doing enough?
So a couple of things. We'll be looking for the Oklahoma ruling to see whether or not the companies are held accountable. There are 2,000, some nearly 2,000 lawsuits brought by states and cities against these companies. And frankly, Joshua, this reminds me of the tobacco litigation of the 1990s, where we saw a mass settlement involving the tobacco companies. It resulted in greater regulation of tobacco, in more restrictions on their marketing, which is clearly something that advocates of these lawsuits against the pharmaceutical companies would want. So I think the first thing to look for is Oklahoma, and that'll give a hint of how the rest of this is going to go.
Byron, might we be reaching that tipping point?
Yeah, the numbers in this report are just absolutely stunning. 76 billion oxycodone and hydrocodone pills from 2006 to 2012. And the DEA keeps careful track of this stuff. We know that in some communities, the consumption level was 300 pills per year per person. If I didn't take any, you took 600. I mean, right. That's just unbelievable levels of consumption. And I do think that there's going to be a tobacco-like settlement for this.
One more story before we go. The Emmy nominations came out this week. Game of Thrones from HBO got a record 32 nominations, including some that the network did not submit, but someone else did. Gwendolyn Christie plays Brienne of Tarth. She was one of three people to throw their own names in for consideration, and she got nominated for Outstanding Supporting Actress in a Drama Series. Here she is as Brienne in a scene from the final season, just before she gets an honor she has long deserved for her bravery and her loyalty.
So Brienne of Tarth defeated the Hound. Pardon me, Lady Brienne.
She's not the sir. You're not the knight.
Women can't be knights.
Why not?
Tradition.
Tradition.
I didn't even want to be a knight.
Gwendolyn Christie as Brienne of Tarth in Game of Thrones. The other two to self-submit were Alfie Allen, who plays Theon Greyjoy on Game of Thrones, and Carice Van Houten, who played Melisandre, the Red Priestess. Allen is nominated for Supporting Actor, Van Houten for Outstanding Guest Actress. The Emmys are on September 22nd. I'm going to try to convince the three guests in the studio to at least watch one episode of Game of Thrones at some point before the Emmys. But until then, Cheryl Gay Stolberg, congressional correspondent for The New York Times. Cheryl, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Joshua.
Eugene Scott, political reporter with The Washington Post. Thanks, Eugene.
Glad to be here.
And Byron York, chief political correspondent for The Washington Examiner. You said your wife's a fan?
She watches it for the family.
Wise woman. Wise woman. Byron, have a great weekend.
Thank you.
1A's lead audio engineer is Jake Cherry, with technical help from Josephine Mionai. Our digital producers are Catherine Fink and Gabrielle Healy. We'll dive into the international section of the Friday News Roundup in just a moment.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from the Walton Family Foundation, where opportunity takes root. More information is available at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. Support for this podcast and the following message come from the American Jewish World Service, working together for more than 30 years to build a more just and equitable world. Learn more at ajws.org.
This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. Tensions with Iran continue to heat up. The U.S. says it shot down an Iranian drone in the Strait of Hormuz. Iran denies that. Iran's foreign minister is in New York this week. He's been speaking to the U.S. media, but what message is he trying to send? Ebola is back in the headlines. The World Health Organization declares an outbreak of the disease in Congo a global health emergency. But why now? And could driving an Uber be the road to a career in opera? Plenty to discuss on the Friday News Roundup. Joining us here in studio is Peter Bergen, CNN national security analyst and director of the International Security Program at New America. He's also the author of United States of Jihad. Peter, welcome back to the Roundup.
Nice to see you, Josh.
Also with us is Indira Lakshmanan, the executive editor of the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting and a columnist for the Boston Globe. Glad to have you back, Indira.
Thanks, Joshua.
And also glad to have back David Lawler, the world news editor for Axios. Dave, welcome.
Great to be here.
Let us begin in Iran, specifically in the waters near Iran. Yesterday, President Trump spoke about the latest incident involving a drone. Here's part of what he said.
Before I begin, I want to apprise everyone of an incident in the Strait of Hormuz today involving USS Boxer and Navy amphibious assault ship. The Boxer took defensive action against an Iranian drone, which had closed into a very, very near distance, approximately 1,000 yards, ignoring multiple calls to stand down and was threatening the safety of the ship and the ship's crew. The drone was immediately destroyed.
That was President Trump speaking yesterday. Peter Bergen, let me start with you. Iranian officials deny that this happened. The president described this incursion in some detail. What do we actually know about what did or did not happen?
Well, I think the broader question here, Josh, is the question of escalation. I think both sides are taking some escalatory positions, but both sides also are trying to avoid an actual conflict. And we've seen a series of things that the Iranians have done, leaving aside their denials on this particular incident, which is either themselves sending missiles via the Houthi rebels into Saudi Arabia, or other forms of kind of escalatory actions. And at the same time, they are increasing the enrichment of their uranium, but they're doing it in a very gradualist way, I would say. So they're kind of trying, both sides are sort of turning up the pressure on each other, but they're also trying to avoid anything that would lead into a real conflict, because both sides have a lot to lose, I think, in a real conflict.
And just, Peter, so we're clear, when you say that they're enriching uranium in kind of a gradualist way, you mean they're not doing it in a way that makes it clear like they're racing to build a nuclear weapon?
No, I think it's 3.67% is the threshold which they've crossed, but they're only getting to 5% now. You need 90% for an atomic weapon. So they're a long way from that. So I think they're demonstrating that, and they keep producing these every 60 days. They say in 60 days we'll do the X. And so there's a lot of kind of signaling about this gradualist raising the pressure from their side.
Now, Indira, Iran's foreign minister was in New York this week. Mohammad Javad Zarif has been speaking to the media. Here is part of his conversation that aired this morning on Morning Edition with NPR's Steve Inskeep.
Zarif did float one possible deal, although it falls far short of U.S. demands. Zarif said Iran could plausibly speed up its planned ratification of permanent nuclear inspections in Iran if the United States backs off some sanctions.
We can do it right now in order to make sure that people can be at ease that Iran will never develop nuclear weapons.
Meaning permanent inspections ratified in exchange for a permanent agreement that is ratified by the U.S. Congress.
In exchange for a permanent lifting of sanctions ratified by U.S. Congress.
That's Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, speaking to NPR's Steve Inskeep on Morning Edition. Indira, I wonder what struck you about what Zarif said and what he might be telegraphing, especially about the sanctions, which have basically been the stranglehold on Iran's economy for some time.
Right. I mean, this is actually quite significant in the sense that it would be an actual step beyond the deal that was signed in July of 2015. So 4 years ago, I was in Vienna, having spent 2.5 years covering the Iran nuclear negotiations, and watched how incredibly difficult it was for the parties to get to yes. And, you know, there were days right before the deal was signed in which Javad Zarif, the Iranian foreign minister, and John Kerry, then Secretary of State, were literally heard yelling through the wall in that room. Federica Mogherini of the EU was trying to calm them down. There were so many parties involved. The EU, they were called 3+3, plus the Russians, the Chinese, the Americans, and Iran. Not easy to get all those countries to come to an agreement on anything. The controversy that hit back home in the United States, although, you know, the deal was signed by the Obama administration, was many opponents of the deal said this is not enough, it's not permanent, that clauses of it sunset after 20 years. What John Kerry and President Obama always said was, there's no real sunset because Iran has committed to never seeking nuclear weapons. The difference here is if they're actually signing a deal for permanent inspections in perpetuity, as opposed to what we now have is 24/7 inspections, surveillance, the ability to call for an emergency inspection anytime we want of their nuclear facilities, but it was all under the terms of a deal which did have certain sunsets. If Zarif says Iran will now make it permanent permanent, anytime, any place, forever inspections, then that would actually be a significant breakthrough. But they would be getting it at a great price, in the sense the permanent agreement by the United States to never impose sanctions on them. That's the part that I don't see happening.
Dave Lawler, what about just the presence of Foreign Minister Zarif in New York? I mean, part of what he discussed in the interview with Steve, and if you didn't hear the whole interview this morning on Morning Edition, go to npr.org. It's worth hearing. Part of what he described as kind of his job as diplomat is to try to prevent war. And if both sides aren't happy with you, you're probably doing your job. But the U.S. also put travel restrictions on him in New York, which seems kind of odd to do for a top diplomat who's visiting your country.
Right, exactly. So Zarif is restricted within a 6-block radius. There are a few buildings he's allowed to go to, but he can't travel freely while he's in New York. This is part of the Trump administration's effort to paint Iran as not a normal country. They don't get to do all the things that all these normal countries get to do. We treat them differently. Another thing that Zarif has been saying is that, look, Trump has said he wants to talk. We think he doesn't want war. Fine, we're willing to talk, but you have to pull sanctions back first before we'll talk. You have to make the first move. And I asked Brian Hook, who's the U.S. envoy to Iran, whether that's something they could agree to. And he said, we'll talk with no preconditions, but we're not going to take the first step. So there's a point at which if they both are willing to talk, but they're not willing to make the first move toward getting these talks, we're going to just continue to have this deadlocked situation.
So then, Peter, what breaks the deadlock? You've got Foreign Minister Zarif saying, well, we'll do this if you do that. The U.S. is saying, well, we'll talk, but you have to move first. Does anything break this deadlock?
Well, I don't know, but just to return to what Zarif said, I thought it was fascinating that he talked about a ratified agreement that was ratified. So, yeah. I mean, they're smart enough to know, like, Obama never had the votes to get a ratified agreement. It was just an agreement, which meant that Trump could get out of it very easily. But they're smart enough to know that if the Senate actually ratifies something, that you know, it actually has some longevity. Because if I'm sitting in Iran at one of the mullahs, you know, who am I? Why would I trust anybody in the United States to do any agreement? I mean, it's not like where the North Koreans are, where there's never been really any substantial agreement that took years to negotiate, as Indira pointed. I mean, this was a very heavy lift. And Zarif, of course, was the chief negotiator, and he's lost a lot of altitude, I think, because the thing has blown up, right? And so the question is, you know, what the administration is saying is this guy doesn't really have any juice, right? That it's really, you know, and that's partly true. I mean, but he is the sort of the face of the regime. But one thing I will say, I think Zarif's presence does show that the maximum pressure campaign is working in a certain sense. I mean, Iran has lost half its revenue from oil in the last year, right? I mean, Lebanese Hezbollah is no longer getting the payments it used to get from Iran. And that's really, so this part of the Trump administration approach is working. What's not clear is, you know, if we get into an escalatory situation, that doesn't really, ultimately that leads to war. Nobody in the United States wants that. But, you know, wars don't happen because people necessarily want them to happen. They kind of often happen in a sort of accidental fashion.
Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky seems to be interested in playing a role in the Trump administration's Iran strategy, meeting with Zarif, going on a mission to Iran. Indira, how viable does that look?
I mean, look, it's not impossible. He has been someone in the Republican Party who has opposed very strongly any war with Iran. I mean, he's more on the, I don't want to use the word necessarily isolationist, but he's on the non-interventionist side of the Republican Party. If Tom Cotton, if Senator Tom Cotton, who's been an incredibly acerbic, opponent of Iran and really tried to undercut Obama's deal. If he said, oh, let me go volunteer, I think the Iranians would laugh. But, you know, it's not incomprehensible that Senator Paul could play a role in some way. I think the important thing here is, as Peter said, the gradualist approach that both sides have been doing in terms of not shooting down anything that had people in it. Mm. And, you know, also signaling we are going this much up out of the deal. The real question that we all have to be looking at going forward, and it's really important, is the deal going to fall apart because of incremental increases in uranium enrichment?
Peter, I wanted to ask you about Saudi Arabia, but first let me get to one more question about Iran, and David, maybe you can answer this one. Our listener asks, how accurate is the information coming out of Hormuz? I'm waiting for the next Gulf of Tonkin-type incident as a false excuse to attack Iran, referring to this confrontation that was used as a pretext for the U.S. getting more involved in the Vietnam War.
Right. So in the latest incident in which the U.S. says it brought down an Iranian drone and Iran basically says, what drone? We have all our drones. You might have shot down your own drone. Somebody is not telling the truth in that case. So some of the information we're getting there is not accurate information. In all of the various instances we've seen there in terms of attacks on tankers in the Gulf, we've had two different versions of information, sometimes more than two versions of information. Obviously, here, what the information we're hearing most prominently is coming from the Trump administration. So that's the official version of events. I was talking to a diplomat from the Middle East who basically said, you, as an American, are predisposed to believe the American version of events. But we've seen things before that lead us to not believe the Trump administration's version of events. And so nobody's going to believe everything that's coming out of either side. And there is a real risk, as you know, people have repeatedly raised, of miscalculation, people acting on bad information and bad things happening. So it is something to be concerned about.
Well, and David, I guess we should also be kind of nuanced, even if the story is correct, because there are drones and there are drones. And like, not every drone is designed to open fire. There are surveillance drones, there are military drones. So even if the U.S. did shoot something down, there are still more questions to be asked.
Right, and I thought we might get this cleared up because actually a Wall Street Journal journalist was on the USS Boxer at the time, but obviously I hadn't considered the fact, and it says in the story that the drone was not able to be seen by the naked eye. So even that doesn't clear it up. You have somebody on the scene, and that doesn't clear it up either.
Let's shift gears and talk about Saudi Arabia. The Pentagon has announced it will deploy 500 troops to Saudi Arabia to bolster the U.S. presence in the Middle East. Peter Bergen, what's that about? Why are the troops being sent there?
Well, it's part of this larger package of about 2,500 troops that have been sent to the Gulf region. There's also been an aircraft carrier group has been sent that was sort of scheduled to go anyway, but we made a big song and dance of it going. John Bolton announced it. So, I mean, it's part of this, you know, signaling that we're expanding our presence in the region. But, I mean, the interesting thing, Josh, about U.S. troops in Saudi Arabia is this was kind of, in a sense, the casus belli for al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. And it is a pretty sensitive issue to have the Prophet on his deathbed said, let there be no two religions in Saudi Arabia, which has basically been interpreted as we can't have permanent presence of so-called infidel troops on the Holy Land. And there are a lot of people in Saudi Arabia who believe that. And Mohammed bin Salman, the effective leader of Saudi Arabia, is taking a little bit of a risk, I think, by introducing American troops into Saudi Arabia because it's not really that popular there.
How does this, Peter, affect kind of the situation with Iran? Saudi Arabia and Iran have all kinds of proxy stuff going on right now.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And what's fascinating to me, the Emirates, who are really the effective ground troops in Yemen, ally to the Saudis, are basically pulling out. And they're leaving. I mean, Yemen is like Vietnam on steroids for the Saudis. I mean, it's been a total fiasco. They haven't achieved any of their goals. A self-fulfilling prophecy has happened, which the Houthis were sort of had very minor dealings with the Iranians. Now they're like a fully owned proxy force. They fired more than 200 missiles into Saudi Arabia. By the way, imagine if one of these missiles blows up in downtown Riyadh and kills dozens of people. I mean, the place is a tinderbox. And so, and as David mentioned, I mean, the possibilities for miscalculation get bigger. Every time you introduce more forces, of course, you're going to have more confrontations. It's just a basic fact of life. If you don't send any kind of U.S. forces into the strait, the likelihood of having some kind of confrontation is much lower. But we are sending more forces, and so the likelihood of confrontation is going up.
And just to be clear, by way of the geography, Saudi Arabia and Yemen share a north-south border. The Red Sea is to the west, the Gulf of Aden is to the south. Yemen sits on the Gulf of Aden, and just north of that is Saudi Arabia. But Indira, the House has said that it wants to block weapon sales to Saudi Arabia. The administration has planned to sell billions of dollars of weapons and maintenance support. The president has talked about doing more business with it was his first overseas foreign trip. So what's the rationale behind this effort to block those sales, and does that seem viable?
Okay, so there has been so much controversy across the aisle. Both Republicans and Democrats actually united last fall against arms sales to Saudi Arabia, or at least there were a significant number of Republicans who crossed the aisle against the arms sales to Saudi Arabia. Really, it was provoked by the Jamal Khashoggi gruesome, grisly murder of the Saudi Arabian columnist for the Washington Post who lived here in the Washington area and was dismembered by Saudi officials in his country's consulate in Istanbul when he went to get a marriage license. It was so gruesome. The evidence was so strong that Saudi Arabia had done this murder of one of their citizens who was a U.S. resident that it became incredibly unpopular to support Saudi Arabia. At the same time, all sorts of evidence had come out over the last year about horrible human rights violations in Yemen, this Saudi-led war in Yemen, including mass starvation, torture at detention camps, all sorts of things. By the way, the Yemen series, an investigative series by the Associated Press, won the Pulitzer for international reporting. That was a series that we at the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting supported. There's been incredible reporting that has come out that has galvanized a lot of Congress against this. However, when Trump announced in May that he was going to evoke emergency authority to push through $8 billion in arms sales deals, now with the House voting to block it, I think what we're really looking at is a likely veto. He's going to override what the House says, and I think that they won't have the votes probably to override his veto. And you can't overemphasize the importance and significance of what Peter said about basing U.S. troops in Saudi Arabia really for the first time. You know, that is huge, and it's the U.S. openly siding with a long-term ally, yes, but also the main force in the Arab world against Iran. And so that, you know, conflict is also very much part of it.
Let's shift gears from Saudi Arabia and talk about the Congo. On Wednesday, the World Health Organization declared the Ebola outbreak in eastern Congo a global health emergency. That comes after one case of Ebola was confirmed in Goma, which is a city of about 2 million people, and another case across the border in Uganda. Now, this outbreak was discovered about a year ago, but until now, it had been confined to rural areas. 2,500 people infected, almost 1,700 killed. Now, this is the second biggest Ebola outbreak in history. Here is the Director General of the WHO, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, speaking at a press conference announcing the decision.
The risk of spread in DRC and the region remains very high, and the risk of spread outside the region remains low.
Indira, and by the way, just to be clear, Congo and Uganda share a border. Uganda is kind of across the northeast border from Congo. Indira, this label, global health emergency, practically speaking, what does that mean? What impact does that have?
Okay, so it affects travel and transit and the movement of goods, which is why the WHO has held off until now from declaring an emergency, because in part they didn't want to cause regional implications that were going to prevent the spread of food and medicine and all of that. Once a confirmed case of Ebola and the man died from it was confirmed in Goma, he had come from the countryside, at that point you have to invoke emergency authorities. And one really interesting thing about this case, which was pointed out by Amy Maxman of Nature Magazine. This is another project we supported, a multi-part series on the Ebola outbreak, and I recommend you all go to the website and find it, is that WHO has been treating this outbreak very differently from the past outbreak in West Africa. They've been taking it seriously from the beginning. Although they haven't declared an emergency until now, they have been working hard to get supplies and the free vaccines from Merck to the extent that they're available and other things into the region. So, you know, it's very serious. This declaration of an emergency may allow them to actually seek more funding. They only have half the funds they need at this point in donations. So I think that that's really important. And the health workers who are on the ground, you know, Amy's reporting has shown, are themselves at risk, not only of catching Ebola, but of being shot and killed, as has happened.
So, David, how concerned should we be that this outbreak could get as bad as the one that was the 2014-2016 one. One of our listeners, Sherry, emailed, "My daughter is in the Peace Corps serving in Tanzania. The spreading east of Ebola is a great concern. From the experts, I would like to know if they feel Tanzania is in danger of infection soon." And Tanzania and Congo share an east-west border on opposite sides of Lake Tanganyika. David?
Right. So what I've seen from the WHO is basically they say they think this will be confined to the region it is currently in. Now, I don't know geographically how big the risk of it is spreading far across Congo's borders. I do know that they are not closing the borders entirely at the moment for humanitarian reasons and also for security reasons. They say if they close borders, the militant groups that are active, it'll only get people will be traveling illegally across borders and things will get more complicated. So they're not closing the borders. They say it will stay in this region, but we have not seen the sort of response from the U.S., for example, that we saw during the West Africa crisis. Barack Obama had an Ebola czar, and it was a big government response there. This has been much more led by the WHO this time around. It's a different response. We're still a fraction of the number of cases in the West Africa outbreak. And I think the WHO has said they think they can contain it within the next year or two. That's a long period of time, but they could get to zero then. So that's my current read.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Let's shift a little north from there in Africa to Sudan. The leaders of Sudan's pro-democracy opposition and the country's ruling military council reached a deal to share power. Now, Sudan has been in turmoil since the military removed the previous president, Omar al-Bashir. That happened back in April. There had been months of peaceful protests, and then the military killed at least 128 people in a crackdown in June. Now, this is not the first time we've heard about a power-sharing deal. There was talk of a deal 2 weeks ago. Last week, the military said it had foiled a coup attempt. Is this a real thing? Do we know the details of this? Like, what does this look like right now? Indira?
Yeah, well, this is a real breakthrough for the pro-democracy movement, who's been protesting for months and months and months, really since the ouster of the 30-year serving dictator, Bashir, Omar Hassan al-Bashir, who was a war criminal for the abuses in Sudan and South Sudan and Darfur. And he has been for many, many years wanted by international prosecutors for war crimes. But whenever he traveled in Africa, nobody ever turned him in. So for months, the pro-democracy movement has been pushing for either civilian control or this kind of power sharing deal. So it is a breakthrough. Don't forget that there was on June 3rd, troops opening fire on the peaceful protesters in Khartoum and killing almost 130 people. So that's a far cry now to a couple of months later, have this council made up of five civilians, five military, and an 11th person to be chosen by mutual agreement by the council. The thing that the pro-democracy people are unhappy about is this military leader, General Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, will run it for the first 12 months, and then a civilian leader will lead it for the following year and a half, and that is until there can be elections.
So, David, how optimistic are we that this will end the violence, lead to a kind of peaceful transition of power?
Unfortunately, you just said how much has changed over the last 3 weeks. We're talking about a military-led council for a year or so. And so a lot of things obviously can change during that time. Tensions are still pretty high. There's a lot of distrust among the protesters for any sort of military leadership, given the fact that, these crackdowns happened with, militias affiliated with the military. Some of their co-protesters have been killed. So I would say it is a good sign. We're not seeing clashes on the streets at the moment. That's a positive step. But there's lots of reason to be concerned that this is not the last we'll be hearing from this revolution in Sudan.
Transitions of power have very much been in the news this week, and that includes in Europe, where there were two transitions of power that are worth talking about. Firstly, with the European Commission. They elected a new president this week, and then we'll talk about Theresa May in just a minute. But on Tuesday, the European Parliament elected Ursula von der Leyen, the president of the European Commission. She's the defense minister of Germany. And after all the thank yous, she made an immediate appeal for unity.
The task ahead of us humbles me. It's a big responsibility, and my work starts now. But my message to all of you is let us work together constructively, because the endeavor is a united, a strong Europe. Thank you very much.
That's Ursula von der Leyen, the newly elected president of the European Commission, who the parliament voted narrowly to support. She will succeed Jean-Claude Juncker when he steps down on Halloween at the end of October. Peter Bergen, what do we know about her and kind of the challenge that she faces? I noted that she said that the endeavor is a united, strong Europe, and that's been a theme across Europe for quite some time now.
Well, I mean, the biggest question is Brexit and what happens. And, you know, in October, the British will decide whether or not to do a so-called hard Brexit, where they just there's no deal and they leave, or some kind of modified version. And, you know, they've had three attempts, none of which succeeded, which has led to Theresa May's departure as leader of the Conservative Party. And looks like Boris Johnson will become the leader. And he has basically said a variety of pretty confusing things about this issue, including that a hard Brexit is very possible. And then also saying, well, you know, actually, that wouldn't be such a great idea. So it's not really clear. Obviously, from a hard Brexit from the EU would be a disaster for the British. I mean, the British pound has lost 20% of its value since the vote to do Brexit happened. And some calculations suggest that the British would lose like $90 billion a year, which is not an insignificant amount of money.
And I just want to make sure we're clear. When we say hard Brexit, you mean the UK leaving the European Union with no deal in place for how to deal with trade and immigration. And so they just leave.
They just leave. I mean, there are a lot of complications, not least that the border between Northern Ireland and Ireland. How do you deal with that? And that is a very difficult question because, you know, Ireland is still part of the EU. Northern Ireland is obviously part of Britain. And, you know, do you create a border there or not? And that is a very complicated question. So, but going back to Ursula von der Leyen, you know, one interesting thing that I was reading about her is the extent to which she really wants to address climate change in a kind of really meaningful way. And I thought that, I mean, she's talking about, you know, very significant cut down on carbon emissions in the EU, which I thought was interesting.
Indira?
So Ursula von der Leyen, although she is controversial back home in Germany, she's a conservative party politician from what's called the European People's Party. And there has been some investigation of her as Minister of Defense for supposed mismanagement. She did win by this wafer-thin margin you explained. At the same time, it's quite interesting. She's the first female European Commission. She's a mother of seven. And despite being from the Conservative Party and whatever assumptions you might have, she took in a teenage Syrian refugee into her home and, you know, helped him learn both German and English. And she has made outreach to liberal and green parties in the European Parliament. So there is some chance that she might actually be a bridge builder and potentially could be effective. So I think we shouldn't write her off all at once.
Now, David, we had mentioned earlier that the new president of the European Commission will take over on the day that Boris Johnson, who is the presumptive frontrunner to be Britain's new prime minister, has said he will take the UK out of the European Union, deal or no deal. Now, we'll know for sure next week after we get the result of the Conservative Party election. Boris Johnson is running against Jeremy Hunt. But the outgoing British Prime Minister, Theresa May, had some parting words.
Today, an inability to combine principles with pragmatism and make a compromise when required seems to have driven our whole political discourse down the wrong path. It has led to what is in effect a form of absolutism, one which believes that if you simply assert your view loud enough and long enough, you will get your way in the end. Some are losing the ability to disagree without demeaning the views of others.
That's outgoing British Prime Minister Theresa May in one of her last major public addresses before stepping down. David, it feels a little bit like Senator McCain's getting back to regular order speech. She also was clearly super frustrated with the process of trying to make Brexit happen. It allowed some politicos like Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Party to kind of rise up and be a louder opposition. But she also dealt with a parliament that couldn't pass anything. Like every deal that came before parliament failed. So how do we reflect on Theresa May's legacy?
So I think the people that Theresa May is most frustrated with are the members of her own party who had this very hard line position on Brexit. Boris Johnson among them who were not willing to take any sort of deal that they saw as a betrayal of this pure vision of Brexit that they had. And so her strategy all along was to basically try and keep the Conservative Party together, find a deal that all the different factions of her party could agree to. I've seen some reactions to this speech by people saying she came to the idea of compromise pretty late in the game. She didn't reach out to the other parties and try and do something across the aisle earlier. I think the reflection on her legacy is, unfortunately, that she came in with one big issue on her plate, and that was Brexit. And she leaves with Brexit no closer to being resolved, British politics more divided. Not all of that is her fault, but it's hard to say that she's been a successful prime minister, and I think you can probably pick up on that in her latest remarks.
Well, and Indira, Brexit has been kind of wildly toxic. I mean, David Cameron was like, if Brexit passes, then I'm leaving, and it passed. And he was like, bye. And then Theresa May says, I can get Brexit done, and now she was frustrated and couldn't get it done. So I don't know. Boris Johnson seems super confident that he can make this happen from every debate or speech that he's given, but this seems to be like the incredibly just purely toxic piece of British politics.
Absolutely.
Right now.
And, you know, we've talked about it a lot in this country as if it's a phenomenon that has coexisted with the rise of Trumpism. But in fact, those people in Britain, the political movements, people like Jacob Rees-Mogg, who've wanted to leave the European Union, have been around for decades. So it's not new. The difference is, I think David Cameron has a lot to answer to history for having held that referendum in the first place, which he didn't need to hold. And he did it, let's face it, as a sort of cynical political play.
It was kind of a
dare.
Control.
It was a dare. Thinking that he would win. He was wrong. Brexit passed. Boris Johnson, we have to hold him incredibly accountable for being like the number one promoter of disinformation and lies that led to the Brexit vote. And he's come out squeaky clean and sort of brushed his hands of it, even after, you know, tricking the British people into supporting Brexit with false economic information, and then sort of, you know, okay, let Theresa May do it. So she's gotten this battering for the last couple of years, and now he thinks he's going to ride in on his silver pony and save the day. And what I think is outrageous is that people aren't more aware of this, of Boris Johnson, who, by the way, has talked about putting UKIP leader, this right-wing Independence Party guy, Nigel Farage, in Washington as the UK ambassador to Washington.
UKIP was the party that championed Brexit in the first place.
That's right. One of the Conservatives and the Tories, too. And then think about how he's going to be replacing a man who was forced to resign, Sir Kim Darroch, who had honestly done what diplomats are supposed to do in cables and say his own analysis of Trump. So the whole thing is so messy. And the idea that Boris Johnson could get into that seat, having caused all this mess, is quite mind-blowing.
Yeah, we did mention the resignation of Kim Darroch, the former British ambassador to the U.S., recently on the Roundup. One more story, Peter, out of the U.K. that we definitely wanted to mention that has to do with the legacy of a man who was maligned for far too long and finally got his due in history. We're talking about Alan Turing. He's a codebreaker, really the genius who helped defeat the Nazis by cracking the code that the Nazis were using to send messages. If you saw the movie The Imitation Game, Benedict Cumberbatch played Alan Turing. He was persecuted for being gay after the war, went through chemical castration, died in the mid-50s, and now Alan Turing will be the new face of Britain's 50-pound note. Mark Carney is the governor of the Bank of England. He said, quote, Turing was an outstanding mathematician who's had an enormous impact on how we live today, unquote. The 50-pound note will include this quote from Turing. He wrote, quote, this is only a foretaste of what is to come and only the shadow of what is going to be, unquote. Peter, I wonder what your take is on him finally getting this honor. And let's be clear, he was the father of modern computing. He was the person who proved that computers were not just programmable, but reprogrammable. That's why your phone has more than one app on it.
No, I mean, I think it's amazing. And, you know, he's going to be on the 50-pound note. You mentioned he died. Of course, he committed suicide, you know, and I think he committed suicide. He was only 41. I mean, he was
about that. Yeah.
Yeah. And he had a terrible, you know,
because of being prosecuted for homosexuality.
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, justice has been done, and there have been various formal apologies that various political leaders have said about Turing, but now he'll live on the £50 note. And of course, it's interesting that Harriet Tubman is not going to be living on the $20 note anytime soon, despite the fact that that was sort of a plan in the offing. But apparently, Secretary of the Treasury Mnuchin has sort of said he's not that interested in it. And it doesn't look like it will happen, even though she deserves it as much as Alan Turing deserves it for different reasons.
And just to confirm, yes, indeed, Alan Turing did die in 1954 at the age of 41. So yes, indeed. Let's move on to two more stories before our time is up. One involving the U.S. relationship with Turkey. The U.S. has moved to suspend Turkey from America's F-35 fighter jet program. That's in response to Turkey getting parts from an advanced Russian missile defense system. David, explain what's going on behind this. It sounds like the concern has to do with Turkey getting military parts from the U.S. and military parts from Russia, and that mix just not being okay.
Right. So Turkey is a NATO ally, and they have purchased this air defense system from Russia that is essentially designed to shoot down planes like the F-35. It's a very advanced system. It has advanced intelligence gathering capabilities. And so the United States had said for a long time, if you get the S-400, you can't have the F-35. Turkey has sort of used this issue to fuel nationalism, this sense that we can do what we want. We have an independent foreign policy. They're also warming ties between Turkey and Russia, which is a cause for concern in Washington. So this is a geopolitical issue as much as it is a military hardware issue. But Erdogan has been talking to Trump and seems to have convinced him that it's not all Turkey's fault. He couldn't get the parts he wanted from the U.S. previously, and Trump seems to be sympathetic to that argument.
Although it's interesting, David, you know, President's new nominee for Defense Secretary, Mark Esper, had some strong things to say about Turkey in his Senate confirmation hearing this Tuesday, said he's concerned about Turkey's growing distance from the U.S. and the West, and Turkey's kind of this sort of semi-black sheep within NATO. It's right on the line of being clearly part of the alliance. So it just kind of seems to deepen the concern over whose side Turkey is really on.
Right. And there was a Bloomberg report quoting senior Turkish officials this week that basically said the U.S. isn't going to do anything serious about this because they know how strategically important we are. Europe's not going to do anything about this because they know that we are the ones holding back a tide of refugees into Europe. So we are too important for anybody to take this step, take sort of steps to really distance themselves from us so we can kind of do what we want around the edges and not pay any penalty for it. We'll see if that's the case.
And we're talking about Syrian refugees because Turkey and Syria share a north-south border.
Exactly.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Anybody use that app online that ages your face?
I haven't, but I've seen a lot of the photos.
I don't understand how, just how. How does this thing become, well, anyway, it's called Face App. You've probably seen it, those pictures of people like, oh, this is what I will look like when I'm 85. You upload a picture of yourself and it makes you look older or younger. And a lot of celebrities have used it. Cardi B and Drake and LeBron James have used this app that uses AI to kind of age your face. And I guess this is fun. But the problem is that this fun comes at a price because privacy experts say that this Russian-owned app could compromise your personal data. New York Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer released a video warning users about privacy concerns. Peter, I know everyone gets nervous, understandably, when we talk about Russia and technology and overreach, especially in light of what happened in the 2016 election. I wonder how much we know about the risks behind this app at all. I mean, facial recognition is, you know, if you have an iPhone 10, you've got facial recognition in your pocket, but how concerned in your view should we be about this?
You know, I mean, I'll just take Chuck Schumer at his word. I mean, I don't have any special knowledge about this app.
Indira?
So basically what tech experts have said from analyzing this is that the difference with this app is that it uploads your face onto it onto the cloud, analyzes it, and it has one of those privacy statements that we all just click yes, I agree on, and nobody ever reads the fine print. And that the fine print is worrying because it basically gives the company, Face App, the unlimited, permanent, non-revocable use of your data, your name, your picture, alteration contributions of your picture forever into infinity with no compensation to you. Now, what the CEO of the company said to the Washington Post was, actually, we normally delete the picture after a few days. Actually, we're not using it in those ways. Actually, it's meant for advertising, so we can, you know, take people's face data and then help advertising. I'm not quite sure how that connects. But I think some of the concern over this, what some of the tech columnists have written, is that we're maybe perhaps a little bit overly concerned about this because it's a privately owned Russian company. And so we immediately think, Russia. It's not specifically the Russian government. There's not as clear a connection maybe between privately owned Russian apps and the Russian government as there is between privately owned Chinese apps and the Chinese government's ability to take them. I mean, I think one good point that is made is whether or not this is a Russian app. Let's say this is an American Silicon Valley app.
Right.
Do you want them to have that data forever and the ability to use it? So I personally would not use an app like this. But, you know, it's possible that it's not Armageddon by having it. But, you know, we do worry about what are they going to do with all that data if they are keeping it and potentially helping companies use it for surveillance.
And let me read you this line from from the terms of service. It says, you grant FaceApp a perpetual, irrevocable, non-exclusive, royalty-free, worldwide, fully paid, transferable, sub-licensable license to use, reproduce, modify, adapt, publish, translate, create derivative works from, distribute, publicly perform, and display your user content and any name, username, or likeness provided in connection with your user content in all media formats and channels now known or later developed without compensation to you.
I mean, the big
sign on that dotted line.
Yeah, I mean, the big problem is we should be all reading our the disclosures that we all get and just press yes on. We should be reading those.
I'll tell you one thing they didn't expect in the terms of service for Uber. And it's what happened to this guy. I'll tell you about him before we go, because it turned out that Uber became his ticket to international music stardom. That is Menzi Ngoma from South Africa. He told NPR he started driving for Uber hoping that he would meet someone that would help further his career in opera. Well, a passenger posted a video of Ngoma to Facebook that got thousands of views, and sure enough, he got an audition with the Cape Town Opera and an invitation to an international talent show in LA. We leave you with his first single called Feel the Love. It's been out for a week. He calls it Popra, a blend of pop and opera, so clearly, the terms of service worked out for him. David Lawler, World News Editor for Axios. David, thanks for letting us use your name, likeness, voice information and spending the hour with us.
Happy to.
Indira Lakshmanan, Executive Editor of the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting and a Boston Globe columnist. Indira, we appreciate the non-revocable contract rights to this program.
Always there for you.
And Peter Bergen, CNN National Security Analyst, a Vice President at New America and author of United States of Jihad. Peter, thanks for letting us own everything you know.
Thank you, Joe.
Our senior team includes Denise Couture, Danielle Knight, and Lindsay Foster Thomas. Orion Donovan Smith edited the show. For more on our team, visit the1a.org/staff. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening and enjoy your weekend. This is 1A. Can you feel the love?